Well, welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. It's a treat to talk to the president of the University of North Carolina, or sometimes called the UNC system. But we get to talk to him a lot. He's our Chapel Hill neighbor. Tom Ross, welcome.
Thank you.
You know, we did a series of these when you first came.
Right.
In December or right at the New Year. Then we did it another time. But we missed last year. So this, we can't say we do this every year to sort of get together, reassess, and think about.
Last year, we were really busy with our strategic planning. And I don't even remember that we had a holiday. But this year's been a little bit more settled down and I think moving in a good direction.
Are we approaching your third anniversary?
Tomorrow will be the end of my third year, and I'll mm-hmm. begin my fourth year.
So, in other words, January from January 1st
right.
on. Well, excuse me for I better not go there. But you remember the old story about Clark Kerr?
Many about Clark Kerr.
Well, Clark Kerr, when political changes resulted in his having to leave the University of North Carolina, he said, "Well, how did you leave?" And he said, "Well, I left the way I came in, fired with enthusiasm." So, I mean, similarly, you've had to deal with changing political fortunes, but you're still in office.
Well, we have had a lot of changes, not just at the university, but in the state of North Carolina, as you know. But at the university, since I have come on board 3 years ago, we have 29 of our 32 board members have turned over. A couple of them have had previous stints on the board. So I think three of them actually have had previous stints on the board, but it's been some time back since they served. So there's been a lot of transition on the board, and it has created, both, as always, challenges and opportunities. And I think it created a great opportunity for us to go back and talk with them about a lot of the issues that we're facing. And I think they've learned a lot. They've challenged us and asked a lot of really good questions and caused us to rethink some things as well. And so I think it's been a really healthy transition. We have good board members that are really dedicated to the university, and that's really all I care about. You know, I don't care what party they come from or who puts them there, as long as they care about the university. And I think this group does, and they're working hard. And they, you know, there was a you could see, I think, in the fall, a time in which people began to come on a little bit about how complex the university is and how many different issues we're facing and how much there is to learn. And they continue to ask really good questions and to try to understand something before they act on it.
I remember when I was working for the university, a lot of people were critical of the North Carolina methodology in selecting board members. That is, that the legislature essentially, I don't want to say owns the Board of Governors, but they choose the Board of Governors. And people said, "Oh, it's just so political. It's just too political." The great thing, from my perspective, was that you had the opportunity to take people chosen by the legislature and then pretty much have full time with them to help them understand the workings of the university. And then they became better advocates within their political community than we could have ever been. And I don't know, do you still have some of those advantages?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, you obviously the legislature elects people that they know and trust. And so when they come to us they can either be adversaries or advocates, and I think it varies from issue to issue. But for the most part, once they learn what's going on at the university, and many of them, as I say, come with a lot of background and knowledge already, because several of them have served on the boards of trustees on constituent institutions, or they had previous Board of Governors experience. So they know a lot when they come, and I think they if they care about the university, then they will be advocates for us ultimately, and that's really what we hope to have. And I tell you, it reminds me, when I hear that critique, it always reminds me of judicial selection. People used to say, "Well, we need to get the politics out of judicial selections." Well, there's really no possible way to get the politics out of a selection process like the Board of Governors. So it's a question of sort of where you put the politics. You know, in some states it's with the governor, in some it's with the legislature. So there's a variety of different places you could put that. I think it's worked well in North Carolina. You know, we still get calls all the time from systems around the country that they want to know how we do it in North Carolina, because I think we are seen still as the sort of the national model, both on the governance side, but also really how we're organized and structured and how strong our system really is.
Well, looking at the university over the past year, you've, of course, had to face a continuing, rigorous, challenging, awful decline, in, relatively speaking, in resources to support your mission. Do you feel like you're over the hump in that challenge now?
We hope so. I mean, I think we, you know, when I first came, my first year, we sustained a little over a $400 million cut, which was about 15.6%. That was a very, very tough time to absorb cuts of that magnitude. And I give great credit to our chancellors and to the people on the campuses that worked so hard to do that, and to the extent possible to do it so that students never felt it. I think they did some, but, you know, the goal is for a student to have a quality educational experience, whether they come to us in good economic times or bad economic times. It shouldn't matter for them. We shouldn't punish them because of the times. And I think we did a relatively good job of navigating through that. You know, we then took another $100 million cut last year, about $115 million. And again, that has been even more difficult, really, in some ways to implement because to the extent we ever had any fat, it's long gone now, and we're trying to figure out which bones to cut. And so it makes it harder at this point for us to implement those cuts. But again, I think our chancellors are doing the best job they can under the circumstances. We said all along that, you know, we have to prove the value of the university. We have to prove that we're worth making an investment in as an institution. And I think we've produced a lot of strong evidence in that regard, and I think we'll continue to do that. And so it is my hope that as the economy recovers and as things get better, that we won't see the level of cuts we've seen. In fact, we maybe won't see any cuts, which would be nice, because we're really seeing the stress. In a couple of places where it's hitting us the hardest, I think, is our ability to retain the best talent. You know, this past year, 37 out of the 50 states increased their investment in higher education. 13 out of 16 southeastern states. We were only one of three southeastern states that did not increase their commitment to higher education. And so that's put other states in a position to recruit faculty. And so they're obviously wise in the sense that they're going to go find the best faculty and try to recruit them to their universities, because it is, in fact, the faculty that makes a university great. And we have some tremendous people on our faculties, but we're beginning to lose them because, you know, they can be offered. We haven't had a pay in, we've had 1.2% pay increase in the last 6 years. And so, you know, our faculty are beginning to see that there are opportunities other places that pay more and have different and better benefits. And so it's putting some real stress on us with the faculty, but it's also, it's hard on our staff. You know, again, we've been a long time without pay raises, and, you know, as the economy gets strong, it brings a lot of good things with it. But one of the things that isn't so good from our perspective is that it means people are hiring and they're looking for talent. And so they find people that work for us, that work in our IT departments or in our public safety departments. We have a heck of a time keeping quality people in our on our law enforcement teams on each campus because they get hired away. There's such demand for them. And so, you know, that's one of the downsides. That's one of the big challenges we face, is being able to hold on to our talent. We have other challenges as well, but those are, you know, that one is certainly at the top of our list.
Well, talking about talent, I mean, when you look at when they publish the salaries of high-paid university officials, the public looking at those and comparing them to their own salaries sometimes says, well, good golly, I mean, those are – how can we afford to pay? You know, even if these are good people, how can we afford to pay them so much?
Right. Well, I think if you look at the faculty salaries are really not all that high. The ones you read about in the newspaper are often the top administrators on our campuses. And as I tell people, you know, you if you're running one of our larger campuses and you've got a $1.5 or $2 billion budget you're responsible for, you know, you want somebody who's talented so that they can manage that well and use that that public resource wisely and provide a high quality experience. Well, if you're going to attract the kind of talent that it takes to run an institution that has a $2 billion budget, you better be competitive with what other people around the country pay. And again, you know, our chancellors, if you look at where they stack up against their peer groups, many of them are below the midpoint. There are a couple that are still right at the minimum, even though they may have 5 or 6 years of experience. So, you know, we're not a state that pays our people really well. It's been interesting to watch the newspaper series on various high-paying jobs and that sort of thing. And the university didn't get much mention in that.
Nice to have the spotlight on other people.
Yeah, well, I don't know about that, but I think it is an indication that it may yet be coming. I don't know, but at least so far it doesn't. You know, I don't think we're far enough out of line with where the peer groups are and where the market is that people are concerned. I mean, we face losing our best people. We had a struggle keeping one of our chancellors last year that's doing a very, very good job. And, you know, you take a chancellor and you're paying them, you know, a six-figure salary, but they're out there raising $30, $40 million a year or more, sometimes $300 million a year, as is the case over at one of our institutions here in this town. And you know, that takes a lot of hard work by the chancellor. And, you know, there's a good payoff on the investment in what you're paying for quality people. So, you know, we have to keep all that in balance and think through it, I think, before we get too critical.
We're visiting with our Chapel Hill neighbor, University President Tom Ross. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is our neighbor, Tom Ross. I get to see him maybe more often than some of you who are listening because our walking route.
Some of each. It's a fair thing to say some of each.
Some of each. Well, I think maybe you're running more than I am. But I want to – one of the things that I think where you earn your pay – lots of different places, but one of them is on the unanticipated things that come up. And you're managing 17, 16 university campuses. And so in a normal year, there's going to be a crisis or two, kind of unexpected, coming out of the blue. And those kind of catch you, they kind of catch you, don't they? And maybe even knock the president of the university off balance for a moment or two.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's the only place I disagree with you is you said we have one or two of those a year. I think it's more like one or two a month. Sometimes one or two a week. They seem to come pretty fast. It's a large system. I tell people all the time there. We have 17 campuses. We also operate UNC Healthcare and our public radio in North Carolina, and I mean public television rather in North Carolina, and the Arboretum up in the mountains. So you put all that together, you're talking about over 60,000 employees and 220,000 students. So one thing for sure, every day when I wake up, I know in my heart somewhere, someplace, somebody has made a big mistake. And the question is how quickly I'll find out about it and how big a problem is it going to be for us. So there's a certain amount of this job that is crisis management all the time because there really is something going wrong almost every day. You would expect that in an enterprise as large as we are. It's a $9 billion enterprise, one of the largest, you know, enterprises in the whole state. I mean, we employ more people than any private sector company in North Carolina. So it's a big, big operation, and there are going to be some things that go wrong. So I think what you have to do is first understand what has happened, what you need the facts, and you have to do as quick an investigation of the facts as you can. And you can't always do it quickly. And at the same time, you have to try to manage the media attention to it, if there is any. And sometimes there is, sometimes there isn't. But and the way I've found to do that in my time is again, I think you can't worry about protecting anything or anybody. You have to go right to the facts. Find the bottom line. What's the facts? And you have to be completely transparent about it with the press. I think it's...
Can you give us... I don't want you to do anything confidential or anything, but can you think of an illustration you can give us of how you, in cooperation maybe with the chancellor, or managed a particular situation that's
I don't want to get into details of particular ones, but you know, you could imagine situations in which something's gone wrong on a campus. There's been staff that haven't fully done their job, maybe in reporting different things under the federal requirements of one time or another. And so what you have to do is first get in and figure out, well, what was the depth of the problem? And sometimes you can leave that up to the campus and say, you know, here's what we want you to find out for us. Go do it. You know. I always work through the chancellor, because it's their campus and it's their responsibility primarily. But there are times in which, you know, if the situation's not, if the campus isn't functioning well, or if they're a problem that the chancellor is not well positioned to handle, well, for one reason or another, maybe it's the chancellor that's had some problem. Then I think you have to be prepared to go in and get the facts yourself. And there have been times in personnel issues, for example, where we send in our own team of people from our office to do an investigation about a personnel situation when there's maybe been a complaint against a chancellor or something like that. But at the same time, while you're trying to gather the facts, I think for us it's also being ready to respond not only to the media, but to alumni and to parents and to students. You know, if it's a situation of public safety, the first group you're going to hear from is parents, and rightly so. And so you have to be able to respond in an accurate and transparent way. It doesn't do any good to say, oh, everything's fine, if it's not fine, because that'll come back and bite you. I think you just have to learn that until you really get to the facts, until you get to the bottom line, you don't know what happened. And you hope and pray that, well, your chancellor's done the right thing, or your police chief's done the right thing, or your IT people have done the right thing if it's been a situation mm-hmm. where data's been released improperly or whatever. So, I mean, you always hope it's done well and done correctly, but it isn't always. And so part of your job is to be constantly vigilant, but also constantly suspicious, and be sure that you're getting the facts, the whole facts.
When something bad happens in a collapse, as you just point out, there's no perfect way to handle it. And mm-hmm. so your chancellor, that is, or the chancellor of the institution, would always, as you would be, subject to questions or criticism. Sure. So how, on this continuing thing at University of North Carolina Chapel Hill regarding athletics, where your board, I suppose, has a interest because they get questions about it, they come to you and you ask questions, then you're really relying on the administration and the chancellor here, in whom you got a lot of confidence. How do you balance that and make your board and the people who are on top of your board believe that you're really doing all that you can, when what you need to do is to give what you feel like at this point you need to help the campus manage the situation?
Well, I mean, again, I think it's a balance, because you do want to trust the chancellor and let the chancellor do the job. And so the way I've found it to work effectively with chancellors is to ask questions. What about this? Have you checked on this? Have you investigated that? Have you asked this question? You know, have you looked at this person and what they did in that situation? And so ask the questions, and that helps the chancellor. If they haven't already done those things, they can then go do them. And I think in working with my board, I try to be completely candid with them and honest with them about what I am doing and what the facts are. If they have suggestions that are good suggestions for me to do something else, I'm always open to that. You know, I don't always have the answers. I have a great staff that also helps me think through how to manage a particular situation. I mean, you know, crisis management is hard work, and there's a certain element of luck. There's a certain element of being prepared for it. But I think you have to have a calm during it also. You know, you can't get all ruffled and nervous about it and start worrying three steps down the road, because those may not be the three steps that show up. It may be something different. And so you have to stay calm. I think that's one of the places where serving as a judge for 17 years really helped me, because I think you hear one side of the testimony and you think, man,
you always know
you're going to do it. Yeah, and then you hear the other side, and then you think, well, maybe it wasn't that way. And so, you know, you just the bottom line is you want to wait till you've got all the facts, not part of them, before you start making decisions. And that's hard for human beings to do, I'm going to tell you. It's been hard for people on campuses. It's been hard for boards that I've worked with over my time. It's hard for everybody because you hear one thing or you read something in the newspaper or whatever, and your immediate instinct is to react to it without ever thinking, gee, maybe there's another side. You know, maybe there's something to it I haven't seen. Maybe because of federal rules or whatever, the newspaper doesn't have all the facts or whatever the case might be. And so, again, I think my training as a judge really helped me to sort of step back and stay calm until I get all the facts.
We're visiting with Tom Ross. He's the president of the University of North Carolina and also our Chapel Hill neighbor here. And I'll be right back.
Check out our comprehensive community calendar, photo galleries, and all of our news stories and more from 97.9 FM WCHL on chapelboro.com.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Tom Ross is my guest. He's the president of the University of North Carolina, and he lives on Franklin Street. Thank you for talking about your job. I'm curious and in one moment, envious, and then in the next moment said, oh, thank goodness that I don't have to do all that kind of all of that stuff. But part of the benefits package for being the president of University of North Carolina is that you get to live in the middle of a really nice town, and your family gets to come at holiday times and other times. 3 years ago, your family, your extended family, wasn't as big as it is now. You got more people in your family.
That's exactly right. First, I'm going to say that before I became president of the University of North Carolina, I lived in Chapel Hill for a while, and right in the middle of Chapel Hill, not far from where I live now, and loved the community and left it. You know, I actually never thought I would leave, but I did when I went back to Davidson College to serve as president there. And it was one of the that was a hard decision we've talked about before for me to leave Davidson, but coming back to Chapel Hill make it a little easier because it's a place where we already had some roots and friends and associations. We knew this guy D.G. Martin really well, and others in town that have made it a pleasure to live here. When we came here, this was our fourth Christmas in the president's house because, of course, we moved in just before Christmas our first year, and I can remember that we had very little furniture, and we sort of pulled some dining room chairs around the Christmas tree, and the heat wasn't working too well. But we had our family there, and it was great. But since then, as you say, there's been some expansion. You know, we had one grandchild then. We now have three. So we just had our first granddaughter born in October, and she was with
Where
us
does she
over
live?
The house. She lives in Washington, D.C. That's my son's child and his wife. And then my daughter and her son live in Charlotte, and they have two little boys, four and a little bit over one. So they're a handful, but lots of fun to have around. So.
Well, the story, they've been here for the holidays or for part of the holidays anyway, and the old story about the lights at Christmas time that I think the second happiest set of lights are the grandchildren driving up towards the house, and the first set of lights are those red lights when they're leaving.
When they're leaving. Yeah. Well, it's interesting you should say that because all of ours left yesterday, and my wife and I think we're both a little exhausted and said something about that very comment about the rear view, seeing the lights in the back of the car as they drive out of the driveway. But, you know, it takes about 30 seconds after they've left before you wish they were back. You know, I mean, they're wonderful to have around because they, for me, they not only provide joy and happiness and innocence in a way that is special with kids, but, you know, it really helps me keep my focus on why it is I do what I do. Because it's not about, for me at least, it's not about the next crisis I get to manage or about, you know, dealing with the board or dealing with problems that we face or faculty or anything else. It's really about creating opportunity for students and creating opportunity for young people like my grandchildren. Someday I hope that they'll get to a point where they're looking to go to a college or university, and I want them to have good choices and to have excellent institutions to attend. And I think we're so blessed in North Carolina to have the University of North Carolina system. You know, it's a, as I said earlier, if you travel around the country, it's astounding how many people view our university as the best there is in the country.
Now, when you're talking to your grandchildren, and playing games with them, can't you get the University of North Carolina off your mind for just a moment?
Yeah, I can in some ways. But on the other hand, it's not just about the University of North Carolina. It's about opportunity, and it's about the future of these kids. And if we don't have a strong public university, it's not just my grandchildren. It's yours and everybody else's that we have to worry about. And we want them to have the kind of opportunities that we've always had. And as I say, you go around the country, what you see is people believe we have the best public university system in America. We don't want to lose that. And I will tell you, the reputation of a university can go down in a hurry. We saw it happen, frankly, in California, where they took such big cuts. What everybody would have conceded was the best is not seen that way anymore. And so we don't want that to happen to us.
If I start, and I ask you to talking about your family, to talk about your sort of new dog, are you going to immediately launch into the great vet school at North Carolina State University does?
Speaking of that, let me just tell you that my previous dog was treated there, actually. And we do have a great vet school. And part of what makes it great is they care about the dog owners in a really special way. I mean, they do. It's a phenomenal place. I can't, I never had any contact with it at all, except I visited it, I guess, when I first came, and they wanted to show it to me. It really didn't mean that much to me until I took our dog Chelsea over there and had her treated, and they were so wonderful to us, not to mention how great they were to Chelsea, that it is a great vet school. It's a great asset for North Carolina. So,
focusing still on the personal aspects of being president of the university, one of the things is that you have to live in an old house, and maybe you have to get it fixed up from time to time. What is it like living in essentially a house that's not yours and that has to be full of people from outside your family all the time?
Yeah. I think it's something you get used to, not easily sometimes, but part of what helped us was, I think when we moved in, a lot of the furniture was fairly worn down, and so we were at obviously a time in which there wasn't resources to do anything about that. And it made sense for us just to use a fair amount of our own furniture. And so a lot of the furniture that's now in use in the house, not all of it, but a lot of it is ours. And so, we brought it with us. And so when you go into the,
So you feel at home, more at home.
Yeah, a room and most of the furniture is the furniture that you've had in the house before and the one before that. It feels more like home. And I think when you put family photos out and you knickknacks that are yours, things like that, you can make it a little more like your home. But it's still not. But it's a state asset. It's a wonderful state asset, actually, and one that needs to be taken care of. So we have been fortunate when I first came to raise some private funds to do some minimal things like replace the appliances because none of them worked very well. We got, in fact, almost none of them worked at all. So we had to do a little bit of work just to be able to live in it, frankly, when we first came. But we've had a primary donor who has been very interested in the house being expanded in a way that would allow it to be used more for events. That house has historically been used for a lot of community events that have nothing to do with the university. Whether it's nonprofits holding fundraisers or, the Literary Society having its annual meeting there, just a number of things like that. We feel, my wife and I both feel, that this is part of our responsibility, part of our public responsibility, is to make the house available because it is a public asset. But we've had this donor who felt like it needed to be expanded so that you could do more of those
anonymous
kind of things.
Donor.
Anonymous donor.
Will we ever know?
Only if the person chooses to let you know. And they've asked that we keep it anonymous. And so we're doing that. But there's not been one nickel of public funds to go into this. And
So you don't have the same.
And let me just say this, too, because I think sometimes when people say, well, it's a private donor, they say, well, but that's money that could have gone to something else. Well, I can only tell you that this money, the person who gave it is well situated, so that they, if they wanted to give more, they could. But more importantly, this is the way they wanted to spend the money.
Well, maybe it means that you don't have to face the same sort of criticism that the governor does when he has to spend or suggest that we spend a lot of money on a bathroom, and then that becomes the focus.
Yeah, I think, you know, let me just say, I think sometimes that's unfair because, you know, these are public assets. It's not, he's not necessarily spending the money on himself, you know. It's a public asset, and you, you don't want to have it fall apart on you. And when, as we've gone through the addition that we've had, it's been a year long process, still going on. Been very painful to live there during that time, I'll be honest with you. You know, this past summer there were weeks without air conditioning and things like that. So, you know, it wasn't a lot of fun for us. But the point is, you know, as we were going through this, we found a lot of really bad problems with this house. I mean, that, for example, when they started looking down at the foundation, there wasn't enough foundation under it. I mean, it was not in good shape. So they had to do a lot of shoring up to just in the house's electrical system was not in good shape. And so, you know, thankfully with this donor's resources, we've been able to, I think, bring this house back to a standard that it's in good enough shape that whoever follows me will come into a place that's in pretty good shape.
Well, how much longer are you going to have to suffer with this project?
Well, we're getting close. I mean, the inside's almost finished, and, you know, they're just at a punch list point, and they've got some more work to do on the outside. The outside still has to be painted. It's, you know, there's a lot of rotten wood and chipping paint, and hadn't been painted, we don't think, since the
80s. So I bet you when you retire,
When
you retire, you're not moving into any old house, are you? I bet you're
probably not. I've had about enough of that, I'll tell you. So
we're visiting with Tom Ross, talking about who is president of the University of North Carolina and our Chapel Hill neighbor. We'll be talking about other things other than the house when he and I return after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with my friend Tom Ross. He's a neighbor of all of us, lives on Franklin Street, and happens to be the president of the University of North Carolina. Tom, thanks again for sharing your personal life and some of the challenges of being university president. One of the things that I covet the chance to visit with you about is the future of not just higher education as we know it, but the whole community, meeting the community's responsibility and opportunity of providing the right sort of training, education, experience for people who will be both leading and providing work and brain power resources to keep our overall community strong. Do you think about those things from time to time, or are you just so jammed up with day-to-day work that you can't do that?
You know, I think it's people always ask, is there, you know, what's the most difficult part of the job, or the most burdensome, if you will, or what keeps you up at night? And I think it's exactly those questions. You know, the day-to-day crisis management, the, you know, trying to figure out how to implement a budget cut, those are things I feel pretty comfortable with. Is a, you know, I've lived through those before and done them in my past in one way or another. But I think trying to see where the future of higher education is going and trying to get us positioned to be in the right place when it gets here, and to try to lead, really, the changes of higher education that are surely going to come is the most vexing issue, I think, that I struggle with. It's because, you know, there's always a rush when change is happening, and we're in the middle of a transformative change, I think, in higher education. And when that's happening, there's a desire by a lot of people to just rush to things. I know we had some of our board members who just, when they start hearing about MOOCs, they wanted this. It was a massive online.
What do you tell some people still don't know what
a massive open online course, which is, you know, a university might put it up online and make it available for free to people all over the world. And there are people that I think thought that's going to change the whole dynamic of higher education. We're going to have, you know, 30 professors put up the 30 best courses there are, and that takes care of everything.
Yeah,
we can shut down all the buildings and the campuses and all that. Well, you know, so there are people that rush to that sort of thing without really, I think, giving it a chance to play out. So I think you have to balance this rush to change with a desire to protect what you know works well.
And what is it? What is it? What is
well,
it?
Well, I still think at the core of education is the human interaction that happens between faculty and student. It is where learning takes place, but learning takes place in an environment beyond the classroom also. We have strong evidence that students that are residents on a campus during their college experience perform at a higher level generally than people who don't, because part of the learning is between students that takes place. That's why it's important to have an environment where students can sit together and debate and talk and argue with each other, because that's part of the way they learn. But at the core is still the interaction between faculty and students. So I think you have to want to protect that and preserve it, because it's critically important. But think about, well, how can we deliver that less expensively to more people? So we're in a world where the potential of technology is huge. We're learning how to use interactive video. Think where we were 5 years ago, with interactive video. I mean, it was a new toy, and I would talk to you, and when I said, "Hey, DG," you'd wait about 5 minutes, and then maybe you would hear me say, "Hi, DG." But now it's real time. We can do labs using video now. I mean, there's all sorts of techniques and things that they're going to allow us to deliver using technology to deliver learning in ways we haven't. It won't be, in my view, just simply online courses. There'll be much more interaction with a faculty member and with, you could imagine what we're seeing already, what we call the flip classroom, where the main delivery is in a online setting. And oftentimes that's assigned for homework. And in the next morning, the students come in and they're with a faculty member in the classroom, and they're doing project-based learning, and they're working on projects together.
They're not just listening.
They've taken control of their own education in a sense. And you can customize education in that way. We're looking at some working with a woman who we brought in to teach us about this from California, who is using analytics to do sort of real-time assessment of what a student's actually learning. So you can put a concept out there in calculus or algebra or whatever, and provide the student with a series of problems, and you'll be able to tell whether they get the steps that are necessary of the formula and how quickly they're getting it. So you'll ultimately be able to customize this education in a way that lets the student go much faster at their own pace or get the help and assistance they need at a particular point. So technology is going to change everything. But I think we have to, I remember when I gave my inaugural address, I talked a little bit about, because I'd said the same thing at Davidson, because I believe it so deeply, that you have to change. But the reason you change is to make your core mission better. So you have to preserve what's really good and then make it better using new techniques and new tools. So I think we're going to see technology. We're going to see all sorts of ways, more collaboration across campuses, whether they're in our system or outside of our system. There are a lot of things that we're going to do. For example, we've got a foreign language consortium we've already built where we're going to be able to teach more languages on more campuses with less faculty. We're going to be able to deliver it, a lot of it online, much less expensively. But there'll still be faculty on our campuses that are there to work with the students. And so those are the kind of techniques I think we'll see more of. So it's an exciting time. It really is. But I think you got to be careful not to rush too quick in one direction, because you may find out that wasn't the right one. And when you're using public resources, you particularly have to be careful, because there's a limit of how big a risk taker you should be when it's public resources you're using. Sometimes it's okay to be second and be right. And so that's what we're trying to figure out.
We just got a minute. But I've been asking you all these questions. What's really worrying you?
Oh, I'm excited about 2014. I really am. I think, 2013 had its tough moments. But 2014, I'm very optimistic. I think the state's economy is getting stronger. I think people's understanding of the value and importance of the university is growing. And we've got a lot we need to do better that we can continue to work on. And yet we've got all these new challenges and changes that are coming fast at us. And we've got to figure out how many baseball mitts we can fit on one hand and catch them all. So we're gonna get it done. And I think it's going to be a good year for us.
Thanks, Tom Ross, neighbor and president of the University of North Carolina, for sharing with us the joys, challenges of both the holidays and your job as university president.
It is truly a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks to Tom Ralston. Thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking. I'll be back here before you know it.